Welcome to Seed to Scale.
We're four investors with backgrounds as founders who met at the engineering school at the University of Pennsylvania.
Tim Young.
Nihal Mehta.
Hadley Harris.
Vic Singh.
We started ENIAC in 2009.
With more than 80 years of combined experience building our own companies.
We now lead seed rounds and bold founders who use code to create transformational companies.
Starting a company from the ground up is really hard.
In this podcast, we'll be having conversations with some of the most interesting founders, investors, and influencers.
About the ins and outs of building an early stage company.
We talk about it all.
Funding, growth, and everything it takes to build a lasting business.
Welcome to Seed to Scale. This is Tim Young, founding general partner at ENIAC Ventures. Today, we're excited to speak with Jake Saper, partner at Emergence Capital. Jake joined Emergence almost 5 years ago after a Kauffman Fellowship and working at Kleiner Perkins. Emergence is the predominant SaaS firm in the Valley with more than $1.4 billion in AUM with incredible investments including Salesforce, SuccessFactors, Yammer, Gusto, Box, and Zoom.
You know, I'm 5 years into this job and it's become pretty clear to me that you're backing the jockey. You're backing the person.
Welcome to the show, Jake. We're honored to have you on today.
I am honored to be here, Tim. Thanks for having me.
So you're one of our favorite investors. We love SaaS. We love Emergence. And would love to hear your journey to venture.
Well, thank you for saying that. You guys are some of my favorite people, too. My journey to venture has been a circuitous one. I always knew I would do something in the entrepreneurial community because of my parents. So my parents are actually co-founders and have started a number of companies and had been doing that since I was young. So when I was growing up, we would sit around the kitchen table and they would talk about the stresses of running their companies. And they had some successes and they had a lot of failures, and I got to kind of see the journey up close and personal. So I experimented with a bunch of stuff. I, you know, had a bunch of small businesses when I was a very young kid. After college, I went into consulting, which I really enjoyed. And then I did a startup that was developing big solar power plants in emerging markets. I learned a ton. I learned a ton about how not to hire. It turns out using management consulting case study hiring frameworks is not effective for hiring Indian civil engineers.
It's amazing. I was also an entrepreneur in China as a young American. It's an amazing experience to kind of launch a company in an emerging market. And you learn a lot.
You learn a lot about yourself.
Exactly. I was just going to, you took the words right out of my mouth. You learn a lot about yourself and just politics and human nature. And it's pretty phenomenal.
Yeah. And when I was in grad school, I wanted to test three very specific hypotheses. Again, back to being overly frameworks driven. The first was, do I want to stay in clean tech? The second was, do I want to start my own company? I wasn't a founder at the solar company. I was one of the first employees. And then the last question I wanted to answer was, did I want to be an investor? I did lead a $15 million equity raise for the solar company and was curious as to what it was like to be on the side of the table. I started a company with a classmate and raised a little bit of capital and experienced that journey. And then I started working at Kleiner Perkins. So I really liked venture, but I knew I wanted to focus a little bit more on kind of Series A and Series B. I was doing growth equity and I was kind of excited to get back into earlier stage company building, frankly, closer to where my parents were back when I was involved there. And so was lucky to get an offer to join Emergence. This was 6 years ago and have been Emergence ever since.
Initially, one of your thesis that I've been really fascinated by, been blogging a lot about, is coaching networks. I'd love to hear about this. I'm slightly biased because I also am a believer in this potential.
Nice.
I'd love to hear your thoughts on this.
Well, so just to take a step back, as Tim was saying, we are a very thesis-driven firm, just generally speaking. So all we do is, you know, B2B software investing. It's all we've ever done. The first thesis was that software would move from on-prem to the cloud. And fortunately, that one has paid off. So the first bet was Salesforce, and it allowed us to invest in a lot of the SaaS companies that have gone on to transform the industry. But we're trying to figure out, obviously, what's next. The whole horizontal SaaS thing is now kind of taking place. The most recent bet is this concept we call coaching networks. I think the best way to describe it is in contrast to what most people are doing with respect to machine learning driven investing today. The vast majority of dollars that have gone into machine learning in enterprise have gone into task automation. So finding ways in which to take low-level tasks and use machine learning to basically automate those tasks away with bots.
Which we call RPA.
RPA is one way to describe it. Okay. That's one iteration of that, robotic process automation. And there are some really successful, exciting companies in that space, UiPath, Automation Anywhere, I think Fortress in your portfolio. So, you know, there's a lot of interesting stuff happening in RPA. What we think has been an underexplored or underinvested in side of machine learning is how to use that same technology, not just to automate tasks away, but to help augment workers that remain and make them better at their jobs. And the fundamental thesis here is that there are certain tasks for which automation will not play a role in any medium-term reasonable scenario. And we believe most of those tasks are going to be human-to-human tasks. Tasks where there is a level of contextual data necessary to process the interaction that a machine won't be able to gather all that contextual data to be able to have the conversation in an effective way. So human-to-human tasks like sales calls or customer support, certain legal tasks or recruiting, there's a whole variety of them. You know, venture capital, ideally, obviously, that's, you know, I'm biased and hoping that stays a human task. But the idea is you need a certain amount of creativity to be able to perform these tasks well, which isn't to say there's not a role for machine learning in those tasks. Basically, the idea would be if you could create a system wherein, as I am on a sales phone call, for example, I could have a machine learning bot sitting alongside me on that call, understanding what I'm saying and being able to process in real time the conversation I'm having with you, the prospect. And if you ask me a question about a competitor, it could tell me, hey, based upon, you know, the demographics of Tim and how much you've been talking and the tone of Tim's voice and everything else that's been said in the conversation, this is statistically the best response to give to Tim's question about the competitor. And then it will learn whether or not I use that suggestion, modify it or ignore it, and then learn what the outcome is on the call. So did the deal close? Mm-hmm. It correlates what I did with what the outcome is, and then it can take that learning and spread it to everyone else in the network, hence the concept of network. And that's what we think makes these businesses so powerful, because there's an inherent network effect in these businesses, which from an enterprise software perspective is actually not very common. If you think about enterprise software, we've had obviously some huge successes in Salesforce and Workday and ServiceNow and some really incredible, impressive companies, but none of them have gotten to the size and scale of the consumer giants. None of them have gotten to the size of Facebook and Google, et cetera. And we believe a core reason that's the case is because almost no enterprise software companies have true network effects inherent in their business.
I would say Zoom, you could argue.
Zoom has viral effects.
Okay.
In the sense that, like, it can spread from person to person. Yeah. But a network effect would mean,
like, each node add value.
Exactly, to each existing previous node as well. Right. So every time there's a new person that joins, not only that new person adds value, but the original person gets value as well.
Right.
And the cool thing about a coaching network is if there's more and more, for example, in my sales example, if there's more and more sales reps on the network, it's not only gets good for the new sales reps that are joining, but it's actually the data in the system makes every recommendation better for me, even if I'm the very first person to join the system. And if you can actually build that, we think that you can build these really defensible businesses. Now, again, I have very little evidence to prove that thus far, which is why I'm a Series A stage venture capitalist.
It makes a lot of sense.
But in theory, it's a beautiful theory.
Emergence theories have been proving out historically.
Things have worked in the past. Yeah. I think, but a part of what drives me behind this, actually beyond just the business opportunity, is I actually think that this is really important to do from a societal perspective. So taking off my venture capital hat for a perspective and just putting on my kind of American hat for a second, or just, you know, citizen hat, there is a massive amount of dislocation that is coming because of RPA and, you know, task automation and those types of things. We can't sit and ignore that from a societal perspective, both like from a, you know, business perspective, because the reality is, you know, there's a lot of opportunity that's being created with dislocation, but also just from a human perspective, right? There's a lot of people that are going to have to find new ways of working. And the reality is those folks are probably not going to, you know, lose their job on, you know, driving a car because cars get automated and then go to some classroom and learn how to code. That's just not the way that you learn, particularly as an adult. The way you learn is by watching someone else do a job. And the challenge is apprenticeship models don't work if employment is distributed across different places and you actually are not close to someone.
Right.
The beautiful thing about this idea of coaching networks is you don't need to be close to someone. You could be a sales rep in West Virginia who's not close to anyone who does this job, and you can get on the system and the system can start coaching you immediately and you can learn from that coaching. You're actually inadvertently learning from everyone else. So the beauty of these things is you could potentially create what we call a digital apprenticeship model. And for me, that's exciting, not only from a business perspective, but also just from a societal perspective.
Another thing that I think we share as a seed investor, you know, coaching a lot of entrepreneurs on how to put together the seed syndicate, who to include, who not to include. And there's this age-old kind of battle that I think has been going for about 10 years amongst the early stage investors around really what does it mean to have a Series A company, which a lot of people argue about the definition, but people mm-hmm. that predominantly write checks and take 20% of the company mm-hmm. for an amount between $6 and $15 million, let's say.
It's gotten so much broader.
Just to be precise, because I get attacked on Twitter when I bring this up without the right precision. And having one of these firms write a small or large check in a, say, like N minus one round mm-hmm. or a round prior to the A mm-hmm. and how that might affect things. And I would love your thoughts.
Just to be clear, I think that the question is, should Series A firms invest in seed rounds? And there's some definitional questions there, but basically that's the core question. I have a bias in this, in the sense that we are a Series A firm and we very rarely make investments in seed rounds. So I should caveat that bias up front. But there's a reason we have that strategy. And the reason we have that strategy is because we do not believe that that's the best thing for the entrepreneur. And there's two core reasons why we think that's not the best reason for an entrepreneur, the best thing for an entrepreneur. The first is, and this one's the one that's most frequently talked about, is this concept of signaling risk. Another way to describe it is there's a lemons problem. So if you have one or a few Series A firms in your seed round, then and those firms do not proactively or preemptively lead your A, then that tells me as an external Series A investor that this is not one of the best deals in their portfolio. It's a really simple concept, but ultimately, if you already have a lot more data on the company than I do as an external person, and if you've been watching that company and tracking them over time, and you're not really hungry to take more ownership in the A, because you're not going to really get your ownership at the seed, then there's a real signaling issue there. And we talk about it every time we see it as a partnership, and we try to figure out what are we missing?
Right. Looking at Series A as a Series A fund, and the Series A fund that invested in the seed round isn't doing it, you have to assume there's a reason behind that.
Yes.
And it's never apparent, right? It's never on its face, but do you want to spend 2 to 4 to 6 weeks digging, mm-hmm. investing all that time and resources at the opportunity cost of looking at another deal that doesn't have this red flag, mm-hmm. And then finally, at the end of the day, the reason why this other Series A firm mm-hmm. isn't super excited and leaning in and yep. buying up and trying to lead the Series A.
Yeah, totally agree. The second core reason why I think this is not a good idea for entrepreneurs is something that I call investor stage fit. So the reality is what I as a Series A investor have gotten really good at and what we've invested a ton of resources in doing is helping companies once they've found product market fit, scale that as quickly as possible. So we're really good at helping you find world-class VPs of marketing or world-class CROs, really good about helping you think about pricing strategy or channel partnerships, all the stuff that once you have product market fit, you can throw the jet fuel on it and really scale. But that skill set's not as useful at the seed because you don't need that. In fact, if I brought you the world-class VP of marketing, that would destroy, it could blow up the engine because the engine's not ready for that. And then vice versa, firms like ENIAC are super, super good at helping you find product market fit. Their firms exist to help great entrepreneurs with great ideas and some initial product traction find product market fit and then pass along, to us to help scale those businesses. That's the way the ecosystem has worked and thrived. And for the deals that I've been involved with where we've got strong institutional seed partners that lead the seed, it's almost always a better board dynamic. It's almost always a better dynamic between the CEO and their investors when there's a really clear lead person at each stage and when that lead person is really, really good at what they do. The challenge when you have, Series A investors at the seed is they don't really know how to interact. So they will either often give advice that is more appropriate for the Series A or Series B stage, which could not be a great guidance for the CEO, or they may just back off, right, and not participate very much. And then you get into this hard thing where if they want to come and lead, let's say they do want to come and lead the A, but they've already invested in the company and they haven't done much work, then the entrepreneur is faced with a dilemma, which is like, well, you're already in, but you didn't do much work. And they'll say, well, it's because that wasn't the right stage. And it'll be like, well, how I know you're going to get involved in the next stage. And you kind of get in this weird situation. And that's all playing out around the context also of the signaling risk issue, which is in the back right. of the entrepreneur's mind. Right. So as far as I'm concerned, raise a Series seed from a firm like ENIAC, just an incredibly high quality institutional lead investor that focuses on seed, and raise your A from an A fund.
I'm biased, but I couldn't agree more.
We should have like a third person here yeah. to like debate the opposite of it. Like, although maybe Twitter will really press that opportunity.
Yelling at me again if you want. So yeah, I couldn't agree more. And even to the argument, the counter arguments are frequently, well, I really want the resources of a marquee multi-billion dollar Series A firm. And again, like your second point, the resources that they bring to bear aren't necessarily appropriate or bespoke to what you're trying to accomplish, which is one. And two, what I've found is when an entrepreneur says no to all the Series A firms, it creates a more demand for the Series A, right? If you take money from one of them, then it's almost like now you belong to that Series A firm. Everyone's going to kind of take a bit of a step back, defer to them, see what they do, sit back and see what they do, right?
Yes.
With the knowledge that they acquire being on the inside for 18 to 24 months. So if you say no to all the Series A firms, then you're a free agent, if you will, and everyone's going to line up to do what they can do to help you achieve your milestones for the A. So and I found I've gotten the deals I've done with no Series A money have gotten way more resources from the Series A community than the ones that have taken money from one or even two or three.
Yeah. And when you raise from a strong seed fund that knows how to play this game, they're going to position you really well to go out for that A because they know the investors that are going to be excited about the A. They know when to make the intros and they don't have to play with the complexity of having some of those folks already on the cap table.
Right. And that's when everyone has the best of intentions.
Of course.
And then I think occasionally, you know, Series A firms are just buying an option.
Right? Exactly.
They're just putting enough money to kind of get on the cap table and, you know, buy an option. And I've seen even behavior where, you know, they don't lead, they sit back. There's an inherent conflict of interest from like the very moment, right? Like once a seed fund invests, we're aligned, right? Mm-hmm. We're only going to take our pro rata. So, you know, we're really aligned with the entrepreneur wanting low dilution and what's best for the company from that day forward. But the Series A, you know, guy or you know, man or woman on the board at that point is they want the company to succeed, but they also potentially want to get a good deal, right? So I've seen that. And it's not necessarily bad behavior, but there's that bias internally where they don't get excited about the idea of raising a super oversized Series A because that means they're going to miss effectively their opportunity to buy the ownership that they really got involved in the first place to buy. And so there's a little bit of a dichotomy of interests, which I think can get confusing, can also get a little bit toxic. Mm-hmm. And I've seen, you know, Series A funds encourage companies to go out earlier than they should. Mm-hmm. Because they know, like, if they wait another 6 months, they're going to hit a certain milestone that's going to make a lot more people interested or the valuation much higher. Mm-hmm. And so there's definitely an inherent conflict of interest as well that people should be aware of. I found another interesting note is, you know, as I've been investing more and more, I'm tending to back more repeat serial founders. Mm-hmm. And I think people that have been around the block once or twice generally are less inclined to take money from a Series A fund right when they start out because they've just seen this play out a few times.
The other thing that's nice that's happening in the ecosystem, so I totally agree with you, second-time founders know these dynamics and so they know to avoid it. I think the allure of taking money from a brand like Emergence at the seed to be able to get the brand value of it is the nice counterbalance dynamic that's happening now is that as firms like ENIAC become more established and their brands themselves become stronger, then you need less of the Emergences of the world at the seed because you actually get some brand value from taking money from ENIAC at the beginning. And I think that's really positive for the industry as well. So as institutional seed funds have brands themselves and start to develop those brands in a stronger way, then some of those incentives, I think, become diluted, which is great.
But thanks for sharing your thoughts on that. I think it's something that's highly debated and there's a lot of kind of dirtying of the water on these issues because there's, I mean, it's, you know, people, you know, I'm biased. I'm clearly biased in this. I want to acknowledge that and honor that.
Yeah.
But I do think fundamentally trying to be as unbiased as possible that entrepreneurs are, if you're crushing it, if your company's just, everything's up to the right, you hit every milestone that you ever dreamed of, this isn't an issue. Mm-hmm. This is more kind of, you know, the majority of cases where you're going into the A and you have, you know, great but not amazing metrics, or the macroeconomic situation is not what you hoped it to be, or just the pendulum of interest in a certain vertical swings back and forth in the valley. And so you can't, there's a lot of things beyond your control. And if you're not, if everything isn't perfectly, the stars aren't aligned for your Series A, it can be hard. And then these like secondary issues become real liability for your company.
Yeah. And I would argue, also acknowledging my bias, that even if things are going extremely well for you, it's still in your interest to maintain the optionality of choosing your Series A lead versus being beholden to the person that you chose at the seed when the business was a different stage and what you needed was very different.
So the other like super interesting and relevant thing that, you know, everyone's been talking about is Zoom, the Zoom IPO. You know, anything that you can share, any anecdotes, like you were, I know you were there kind of through that entire cycle and, you know, learnings, thoughts, takeaways.
Zoom is just an incredible company with incredible people behind it. So the backstory from the emergence involvement is we started getting to know the company in early 2014, and we were actually looking at, we had a thesis that there was space for a next generation video conferencing player. Obviously very crowded with lots of existing players, but you know, we believed that work would get more distributed and we believed that we needed a better system with which to do that. I joined the firm, and actually the first deal that I led diligence on after I joined was Zoom. And so we kind of had this whole, you know, prepared mind around video conferencing at that point. And the diligence effort at Zoom was incredible and totally different from any other diligence effort I've been involved with. In particular, Eric, the CEO, is an incredibly humble person, and I think that comes across in any interview that you can watch him do. But he was even humble with respect to the state of his business back in 2014. We asked him for a data dump of, you know, his customer information, and he had given us some high-level, you know, information about the company and how well it was doing. He gave us a bunch of data, and we needed to kind of, you know, sort through it and clean it up, and we helped him clean it up and structure it in a way that he could use it to help him run his business. But we also discovered through the process that the business was actually performing better than Eric even thought. And he just, like, the data had been messy, and, you know, he was being conservative in his portrayal. And that's not that common to, you know, go through a pitch process and then have entrepreneurs give you the data dump and then discover that the business is actually much better than they had even said. But that's kind of been the story of Zoom all along, honestly. I mean, he exceeded plan every single quarter since we invested. Wow. He never spent a dollar of our investment from back in 2014. He was profitable literally back then.
Wow.
Which is just, I mean, it's an amazing thing of beauty to match that with the growth rate they've had. To be clear, it was a very stressful diligence process. It was the largest check we'd ever written. Or it was the largest check we were ever going to write. Still actually the largest single check we've ever written. It was a $20 million initial check.
Wow.
And that fund was a $250 million fund. So it was a big part of the fund. So it was very high stakes. It was also, you know, the first one I was leading diligence on, so it was high pressure for me too. My wife can attest to those late nights. But obviously, you know, we're super, super proud of Eric and team and what they built. So proud of him.
So we do something called the lightning round. I'll ask you a few questions and you just say the first thing that comes to mind.
Let's do it.
Okay. So question one, what is the best and worst advice you've ever received?
The best advice I've received is that venture capital is ultimately completely a people game. And I think that I've wrestled with this over time. You know, are you backing the jockey? Are you backing the horse, et cetera? And ultimately, you know, I'm 5 years into this job and it's become pretty clear to me that you're backing the jockey. You're backing the person. There's a few investments we've made where the business is completely different than it was when we invested. The only thing that's the same is the person. And a couple of those have performed extremely well. And if you look at the history of, you know, venture capital, outcomes like Twitch, outcomes like Twitter, outcomes like Slack, those were bets on people that ended up paying off, not bets on the business model. So that's something I keep in mind a lot. Worst advice I've been given? That's a really good question. One like thing I've been really conscious of, particularly as I spend more time speaking with folks that are kind of up and coming in their careers, to be aware of with respect to advice is that the vast majority of advice that you get when you ask for it is someone just repeating what their life was, right? It's someone just saying, well, here's what I did, right, and therefore you should do it.
What's the best part of being in venture?
So for me, the best part of being in venture is really clear, which is it's the relationships that I get to develop with the CEOs I work with. There's so much meaning in those relationships. They're so beautiful and complex because you play, you know, the relationship, you're not their boss, you're not their direct report, you're not their peer, you're not their friend. You're all of those things at different times, right? And you got to figure out, when am I wearing this cap? When am I wearing this cap? And when you go through an experience over a long enough time period and there's ups and downs in the company, you end up getting super close to these people. Mm-hmm. And you connect with them as a human in a way that I haven't connected with other people in the past. It's a way that it's just, it is, you are in the trenches with them, and their job is so lonely, and if you do your job right, you are their person. Well, it's sort of the opposite in some recs. So I'm doing an exercise right now where I'm doing a calendar audit, where I look at how I'm spending all my time. And so there's this constant tension, because I want to spend most of my time with my CEOs, but I know that I have to find new CEOs to work with to keep the business going.
Yeah.
And so for me, the hardest part is time allocation, time management, and trying to balance between those two demands.
Well, thanks so much for coming in today. And just to make sure everyone's aware, how can people reach out to you on Twitter, social media?
So I'm on the Twitters. I think it's Jake Saper, at Jake Saper. And that's probably the best place to get me, or LinkedIn. But before we go, I want to say one thing, which is that presumably people listening to this podcast are familiar with ENIAC, but many of you probably haven't spent time with the folks in person that run this firm. I've been lucky to spend a lot of time with Caitlin, with Tim, with Nihal, and with other folks on the team. And it is amazing the humanity with which they connect with each other. And I feel like that I've gotten to see that also with some of the entrepreneurs you work with, and that is so unique and so special. And it doesn't come across in a podcast probably, but it's an encouragement that if you have the opportunity to spend time with the ENIAC team in person, highly recommend you do it, because they are so authentic.
Thanks for coming in today and joining us on Seed to Scale.